From KCRW in Santa Barbara, I'm Jonathan Bastian, and this is the 805, Stories from the Central Coast. This week on the show, first it was helicopter moms, now it's lawnmower parents. That's according to Starshine Rochelle from the Santa Barbara Independent. She joins us to offer her advice for a more laid-back approach to raising kids, especially in the wake of the college admissions scandal. We'll also hear from Santa Barbara's newest poet laureate and her quest to take poetry from the university to the streets. But first, we begin with a walk through the Elwood Mesa Preserve in Goleta. This park, located right by the beach, was once home to thousands of monarch butterflies. They came here every winter and spring to nest in a sprawling grove of non-native eucalyptus trees. But in recent years, these trees have been dying fast. Following years of drought, trees have toppled over. For many still standing, you can hear them creaking and groaning in the wind. When we visited, we didn't see a single butterfly in the grove. Karis Vanderhyde is a biologist and volunteer with the Xerces Society, an organization that's trying to protect monarchs and other species. She met me at Elwood and says this is a major problem all over California.
This last overwintering season, the 2018 to 2019 overwintering season, we've noticed a marked decline from the year before. In all of California, there was about 28,000 monarchs recorded in all of California overwintering, which compared to last year, there was 192,000, which is approximately an 85% decrease from the year before, which is shocking.
And what about in this area here? I know you guys have been keeping close tabs on butterflies over the years. Can you give us a sense maybe of the last couple of years of the decline and where we are now?
This last season, our monarch numbers peaked at 231, which is a 99% decline from last year, which we recorded 7,044 monarchs.
And part of the issue here is what's going on all around us. You know, we're sitting in this beautiful field with hundreds, if not thousands, of eucalyptus trees around us. But many of them, as I can see, are falling over. We see branches on the ground. And we're kind of looking at maybe the reason for their habitat loss.
That is correct. California, as you know, has experienced an extreme drought for several years. And this drought has put these eucalyptus trees under drought stress, and several of them have died and also lost canopy. When these trees lose their canopy or lose their leaves, it decreases the amount of wind protection that they're able to offer at the monarchs at these overwintering sites, which then allows the stronger winter storms to come through, stronger than they would have, and could likely be causing more mortality of these monarchs. A few years ago, you couldn't be able to see the sky along the horizon here, as you can look through the trees and see the sky. These trees used to be so dense where you could look up and barely see the sky. That's just a marker of how the canopy is decreased.
That's incredible. I mean, in just a couple years, we've seen that much of a decline.
That's correct.
Lastly, do we know, are these butterflies, are they just dying off, or are they going to other wintering sites around California?
Monarch butterflies are highly mobile, and they will arrive at an overwintering site, and if it's not quite what they're looking for, they will move to other overwintering sites. So in previous years, we've seen monarchs move from one less suitable site to another. One site might have a tree fall over, and it's then less suitable, so that we see a higher population the following year at another site that is more protected. This last year, however, the monarchs have had a low population at all of the overwintering sites, and some have had no monarchs at all.
So, I mean, there could just be a major decline, not just here, but as you mentioned in your earlier stats, all of California.
All of California is suffering a steep decline.
Well, now I want to turn to Ann Wells, who works in planning and environmental review with the city of Goleta. Ann, thanks for joining us out here.
I'm happy to be here.
We've been talking about the state of these eucalyptus trees, and you've been involved in kind of what could be a major change out here, or funding that's been secured to kind of try and restore this habitat. So give us a sense of what this new program is going to look like.
Sure. I think to give you a sense of what the program is like is to talk about the journey that we went through to get the program in place. We started in 2012, and we started working on a management plan to improve the conditions for the monarch butterflies, and we had high numbers then. So we were really looking at research and education programs and understory restoration and maybe some new plantings to get a multi-age canopy. And then we started getting a die-off. And with the die-off, we had to do new research. So it took us almost 8 years to be able to write the plan in such a way that it could address these new conditions, where, as Karis was saying, we can see the sky. So the importance of restoration was stepped up in the management plan. So the management plan that was just adopted by the city council is now ready to be implemented. We are securing a large amount of funding that the state has so generously allocated to the city of Goleta. $3.9 million is a lot of money. And that says something about the value of this eucalyptus grove on Elwood Mesa to not just our community, but statewide, to biologists, but also to just visitors and general tourists, educators. It's a really important site. It's easy to access. It's public land, and it really needs help.
Yeah, so tell us how that's going to work. $3.9 million from the state. So where is this money going to go? What's kind of the top priority in terms of using these funds?
So the top priority for using the funds is to better understand what the butterflies need and better understand what's happening out here in the groves, and then get some water out here and look at the long-term conditions, get a vision for what we want in the future and start implementing it. So the funds will go largely to restoration, to getting buying plants, to installing irrigation, to educating the public. And so those are the priorities. You know, before 5 years ago, the priorities, again, were more kind of research-oriented, and now they're more planting-oriented.
Yeah. And is the plan literally to replace the eucalyptus trees?
The plan is multifunctional, so it's to remove some dead or diseased trees, to have some pest controls, to remove non-native understory species that are competing with the butterfly habitat, and to replace with the eucalyptus trees within this canopy area, and also to replace with natives so that we can get an edge effect, so that we're having some natives on the perimeter, but really focusing on those eucalyptus to restore that habitat function.
It seems like a complicated scenario, because on one hand, the eucalyptus are non-native. We know they need a lot of water. We don't know if we're going to get that water moving forward. Maybe the butterflies like them potentially. So, I mean, planning wise, it makes you think, how do you go about doing this in the right way?
Yeah, I mean, you really hit on a big topic of non-natives. You traditionally don't want your non-natives. You don't want to plant them. You want to remove them. But in this area, our trees serve a different purpose. They're planted by Elwood Cooper. They're part of our history in Goleta. And they're host to so many different special status species like raptor nests. And you can hear a lot of birds in the background, yeah, probably. And then, of course, the butterflies. So they're to some degree naturalized. The public has spoken, and they are very, very protective of our eucalyptus canopy here.
Were there ever thoughts that of just moving on from the eucalyptus? But, I mean, as you said, I mean, they've kind of created their own, I don't know, environmental conditions, and other species rely on them now.
Yeah, I think we're unique in that way, in that we have created a forest where there probably wasn't one before, and it has done well until this recent drought. When you have non-native naturalized species, usually you need to do a little bit more management than you would with natives, which is why we need to get in here and do something rather than just let nature recover on its own because of that non-native influence.
I know it must be hard to put a timeline on trying to get this butterfly population back up. But is there a hope that we could see some turnaround here, or what would you say?
We believe that if we can restore the habitat, that there's no reason that the butterflies wouldn't be coming back. The state is working to protect the species, or the federal government's working to protect the species. And so with that, looking at it from a larger context, not just a local Goleta context, that we believe recovery is possible. Other species have recovered, like the pelican, for example, is a species that now is abundant that was once almost decimated.
Ann Wells, with the Planning and Environmental Review Department and manager there, thanks for your time.
Thank you as well.
And Karis Vanderhyde, volunteer at Xerces Society, thanks for the time.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
This is the 805 on KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian. With great novelists like T.C. Boyle, Sue Grafton, and Ross McDonald, Santa Barbara is well known for its fiction writers. But since 2005, the city's been promoting poets as well, with the creation of the Santa Barbara Poet Laureate Program. The job of the laureate is to become a spokesperson for the city's literary community and help spread poetry across the region. Today we're joined by Santa Barbara's newest laureate, Lauren Bossler. Thanks for joining us.
I'm so happy that you asked me to come.
Well, congratulations, first off.
Thank you.
And I think I should first mention, you have kind of an interesting story that kind of took you here. You're from Belgium originally, is that right?
I'm from Belgium originally, and I lived there and raised my children and had a career, and I thought that I couldn't go any further in my career. I had reached the glass ceiling and sort of wanted to change my life. And I talked to the children and I said, let's go somewhere,
yeah.
You know, Italy, Australia, whatever. And one of my children said, let's go live where the Marlboro man lives, because she had seen an advertisement of a beautiful, handsome cowboy on a horse with mountains in the background. Yeah. So we moved to Colorado.
What a very American image, right?
Right.
So that takes you to Colorado. And I have to imagine, I mean, you were writing poetry along the way. It was a part of who you were.
Yes, I published poems in French and wrote poems in Flemish, and I translate poems from English to French, English to Flemish, Flemish to English, etc.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And I wrote a lot while my children were finishing high school in Colorado.
Right.
And then I met my husband, Kurt Brown, who was the director of the Aspen Writers Conference.
Right. This is a connection we share, as I'm a Colorado native, yeah.
Exactly. So yeah. We have that beautiful landscape, you and I, in our hearts and memories. And then later, my husband and I moved to Boston, where I taught at Emerson College, then New York, where I taught at Sarah Lawrence College, and finally, we retired here, where the first poet laureate, Barry Spax, gave me a job at UCSB, very generously, as he always was, Barry.
Yeah. Tell me, actually, if you can kind of reach back in time a little bit and you remember kind of making your way to Santa Barbara, you being an artist, a writer, what was going through your mind when you were kind of greeted by this beautiful but very different landscape to where you were before?
It's the light. I mean, I could not believe the quality of the light. And I for my inauguration or installation as poet laureate, it makes me laugh because it's installation like a washing machine or
a
kitchen cabinet.
A little bit, right.
But for my installation, I wrote a poem and I talked about the light in Santa Barbara. And I said, even the shadows here have a different light.
Yeah.
They glow differently. Yeah. And also the community of poets here is so generous and so welcoming and diverse, which is something that I hope to develop even more as poet laureate.
Right.
I'd like to offer free poetry workshops, poetry classes, lectures at the Santa Barbara Library, and maybe teach Hispanics to translate their poems in English, and also translate English poems into Spanish.
Yeah.
just to reach more people with poetry here.
Yeah, because, I mean, sometimes we think of poetry as being kind of stuck in the university or
right.
an MFA
no,
program.
No,
but
no.
but what I'm hearing yes. is you want to be more of an active poet laureate.
Right.
Is that right?
Right. I would love to bring it back where it was originally,
yeah.
in families and in the street. It wasn't in academe, you know, for millennia. It was just around the coffee table, the breakfast table or the whatever, the kitchen table. And people recited poems that they had learned from their grandmother, that they had learned from their grandfather. And poetry was something that was exchanged and read in long evenings. People read poetry around the table.
Right.
And then suddenly it went to academe, and that's fine. But I'd love in Santa Barbara to bring it back down to the streets and the young people and
yeah.
And the parks and have open readings
yeah.
and come who may.
Yeah. I hear you. I want to hear some of your work. And,
mm-hmm.
and there was one poem of yours that really caught my attention, and because it speaks of the landscape. It speaks, I think, of the beauty of the region coupled with what can also be the ferocity
and
the
horror,
danger and the
yes.
horror of it. I don't need to tell our listeners all the things that have happened in the last couple of years. Tell us the name of this poem, and I'd love to have you read it.
It's called Sundowner Wind. And also, Sundowner Wind was an expression I'd never heard.
Mm.
So I researched it. It's such a beautiful
yeah.
word, Sundowner Wind. Here's the poem. 3 days now, and the sundowner stubborn, a hot hiss in the jacaranda. It's in bloom, and there's no blue like this one, dusted by drought and dusk, but flowering all it can, raising its fists to the other blue up there, sun-fraught, contrailed, hazed and exhausted with light. But there, unfailingly there. The streets are empty, but for a mockingbird on a roof, he too doing all he can, singing to the scorched mountains pockmarked by the tea fire. The sundowner danced with that fire for days, its flames still a rage in my old friend's eyes. She lost all she had to it. I think of her often, bending over, sifting pottery shards from her house's ashes, and finding solace there. My God, solace in so little. The sun is down. The wind dies in the tree. I thumb the two wedding bands on my finger, have them do their little dance together. Their sound, a tiny ring in a stillness that can't silence everything.
Thank you. There's so much in there that obviously resonates. I think of the image, of course, of a woman looking, as you said, the pottery of her house.
Shards
yeah.
of pottery.
Yeah. I mean, I just think of the interviews I did with people that have been impacted by this type
right,
of stuff as
right,
they survey
right.
what's left in their
right,
life.
Right.
And clearly this is something that had been on your mind. Say more about that.
Well, I was invited at her new house, and there was this strange table, and the surface of the table was all these little pieces of things, of plates and shards.
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
did not know. And I said, that's such an interesting table. What is it? And she told me that she had poured cement and then encrusted everything she could
wow.
find in those
of
ashes
her past, of, what
of
she
her
had.
Past.
Wow.
And that's all she had. That's all that was left.
Mm.
And so that... For someone who hasn't gone through that, just to close my eyes for a minute, put my hands on the table and say, that's all that is left from your life before the tea fire.
Yeah.
And have to rebuild. And that's what Santa Barbarans do. They rebuild and they stick and they stay. And I think it's because of the magic of this place.
Yeah. I kind of wonder how you have become part of Santa Barbara, how you feel like your relationship to it has also expanded or grown, or how you've come to realize things like that. How has it changed for you being here?
I come from a dark gray country.
Yeah.
And I come from a very dark past. I grew up in a nunnery. My parents put me there when I was 3 and a half. I escaped when I was 17. I had a very dark past. And coming here, the light, the ocean, those endless shores with the waves full of light just crashing at your feet, the kindness and the welcoming of people here, also the distance. You can't be any further from rainy, dark Belgium than sunny, beautiful Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
And also, I have a child in Los Angeles, another child in San Luis Obispo, and I'm in the middle. So they can come for a mama meal when they want to.
Oh.
I love this place. Yeah. I love this place. I love its inhabitants. I don't want to move. And I'm in love with my jacaranda tree. I live almost under a jacaranda tree. And we have a great relationship, that tree and I.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lauren Bosseler is the new Poet Laureate of Santa Barbara. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you for having me, and I mean that. I'm not being polite. Thank you.
This is KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian, and it's always a pleasure to be joined by Starshine Rochelle, columnist at the Santa Barbara Independent. Nice to see you, Starshine.
So glad to be here. Thanks, Jonathan.
Really enjoyed the latest column. Are You a Lawnmower Parent? Call admission scandal reveals dangers of clearing smooth path for kids. It's kind of interesting and funny and sad or whatever to just think about the evolution of terms like helicopter parents and where we are now with lawnmower parents. It's obviously something you've been thinking about.
I have, much to my shame. I knew I wasn't a helicopter parent. That's one of those terms that feels very extreme, and a lot of my friends and I sort of dismissed it. I'm not that. That's not me.
Sure.
But when we heard lawnmower parent and what it means, we went, I might be that.
Right. And what are some of the defining characteristics of it?
So a lawnmower parent is someone who sort of walks in front of their child and clears the path to success for them, you know, pushing away any obstacles, any discomfort, any challenges that they might have.
Right. And right on the face of it, that doesn't sound too bad, but it could have some unintended consequences.
Exactly right. So it has consequences for the child, and it has consequences for the people around the child, right? I mean, externally, no one likes a person who's used to having everything done for them, right? We don't like those people in society. They're kind of annoying. But for your own child, it has consequences too in terms of, you know, it prevents them from learning how to fail and to become resilient from those failures.
Right. And what would some examples be, let's say, that you may have come across, or dare I say, maybe even exhibited some of the traits yourself? As you write in this article, a lot of folks maybe have aspects of the lawnmower parent in them. What could they be these days?
Right. So on a small level, it's just little things like, you know, bringing your child their lunch at school when they forgot it. Things like that seem like, of course you do that. No one wants their kid to go hungry, right?
Right.
And on an extreme example, it's everything from that all the way to the college admission scandal, which really got people talking about the lawnmower thing.
Right. In this case, it was literally, I'm just going to get you into college.
Yeah, whatever it takes.
Right. Now, if you were to dig into your basket of lawnmowering, anything you would want to share with us of what you may have done or seen, let's say?
Yeah, I notice I've been a lot more sensitive to it lately, so I've been thinking about that. And I realize there's times when I've made contact with my children's teachers when really they should have done it themselves. Or, you know, I see a lot of it happening in Santa Barbara where, you know, a lot of us, you know, people who live here have more time, more money, just more resources. And we want to help our kids. Who doesn't want to help their kids succeed, right? So it feels like you're doing something good.
Yeah.
But in fact, even by bringing a lunch to a child who forgot it, you're depriving them of the opportunity to know what it feels like to have to, you know, sort of bum crackers and snacks off their friends or remember next time, like, God, I don't want to be hungry again.
Right. And it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned in this article that long term, I mean, we are seeing these kind of higher rates of depression among children or teenagers or folks in their 20s. And it's not crazy to say there could be a correlation to some of this.
I've definitely heard experts say that, you know, people who grow up without ever having to face frustrations or challenges challenges, they come to a point in their life, as we all do, where life starts to sort of knock them around, and it will. And if they've never had to deal with that before and suddenly they do, of course they're going to be depressed. You know, of course they're going to find that really, really challenging.
Right. And one of the key words we hear oftentimes in education is instilling this idea of grit in a child, right?
Yeah, that's huge right now.
Which is essentially, you know, what do you do when things don't work out for you?
Exactly. I mean, it's so important to be able to come to these opportunities where you face down a challenge or a disappointment and sort of square your shoulders, take a deep breath, tell your kid, you know what, this happens. How are you going to deal with it? How are we going to learn from it? Move on. It happens to me too. This is life.
And I'm not a parent, but I can imagine just the difficulty of this in, on one level, right? Wanting to help, to be assertive, and on the other hand, wanting to distill this idea or teach this idea of grit. I mean, how do you do that gracefully, right? How do you find that balance?
Yeah, it's really hard. I was trying to think of that myself. And I remember that, you know, when our kids are really little, we have to watch them struggle to learn some things on their own, things that we can't help them do, like learning how to walk, learning how to talk, learning how to feed themselves. You really can't do that for a person, even learning how to fall asleep. And then as they start to get older, you know, we start to find that we can help them with things. Ooh, I can make a phone call for you, or I can send an email, or I can intervene, or I can spend money and make things easier for you. And I think that what happens is as our kids start to get older and we become, frankly, really less and less useful to them, maybe we're trying to insert ourselves and make ourselves useful where we really shouldn't be.
Yeah. Well, I love the last couple lines of your piece. You say, my helicopter is grounded, my lawnmower is in the shed, and I'm aiming to be an Airstream parent.
Yeah, I was trying to think of a new term.
Can we run with that, Airstream parent? What does that mean, just
for
fun here?
I was trying to think, like, if we're going with these, like, motor vehicle labels, what would be a better one? What would be a more, you know, safe one to be? And I was thinking, oh, how about, like, a cool, chic Airstream trailer that just kind of, like, lagging behind the kid a little bit,
right,
with the, you know, the sense of home, all the provisions of home, comforting, safe. If you need me, I'm here. But like, otherwise, you got this, kid.
All right. We're going to go with it. It's been coined today on KCRW.
You heard it here first.
That's Darshan Rochelle, columnist of the Santa Barbara Independent. Darshan, thanks again.
Thanks, Jonathan.
That's it for today. You've been listening to The 805 on KCRW in Santa Barbara. You can learn more about the show at kcrw.com/the805 or download the show wherever you get your podcasts. Today's show was produced by Carolina Starin. I'm Jonathan Bastian. We'll see you next week.